Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by my co-host, Bryce Castillo.
Hey, Andrew. How's it going, man?
Fantastic. And Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. Good to be with you.
Yay. You know who can't be with us?
Old Salty Tushwood. He is out at his stately manor, looking to I don't know, build some kind of hell pit that everybody can worship around.
Actually, I was going to say he Jayenkyu, but also Brian, too. he Jayenkyu can't be with us either. You're like, hey, who's this guy? Remember last week we talked about the story about, you know, the Chinese may have been doing gene editing on babies, like having babies that were gene edited, which we all agree is the future. But hey, when the future hits you at first, it's scary.
Yes.
Headline today, Chinese gene editing scientist is missing amid rumors of arrest.
Oh, no.
apparently when that story made headlines around the world, maybe some people, maybe he crossed some lines or something, and, you know, in typical Chinese fashion, we don't know. This disappear you. You just, you know, they take you to
come
police
on,
station.
Andrew. I'm sure you can just go right up to the Chinese police station and request request an arrest report, and you know there's due process, so he'll be able to get a lawyer in there immediately, so they can hear a full recitation of the charges against him.
Tell us again where many Chinese police stations are located, Justin.
Oh yeah, I mean I guess they got to be. Well, you know I'll be on the hunt. I'll let you guys know.
You might find one there in Oakland, probably.
Yeah, often what they do is they put police stations are in like you know, they'll be under the basement of TGI Fridays in Beijing or something. Like, they have secret police stations, detention centers. And China's big, so you're like, hey, I'm missing, you know, my wife. Like, not here. Where do I look? Not here. Okay, let me just look up a list of Chinese police stations in the phone book.
So I don't know if this was an afterthings topic, but I know we had talked about the Chinese actress who went missing and has since reappeared in the past week or so. Do we think that we see this guy again?
Fan Bing Bing was one that was, he'll show up again. Often what happens is they spend time and, you know, it's like, in China, you know, they're doing for the Muslim population, they get in the, you know, the Unguars, you know, those people, is they go to vocational schools. They have these really wonderful vocational schools where they teach them new skills behind barbed wire and guard towers. But they're vocational schools. They teach them skills like
Breaking rocks and
don't, you know, like don't be weird or what we think is weird or anyhow. So, generally, these people surface a lot later and are very apologetic and, you know, contrite for their ways and agree to, you know, be good citizens.
Sometimes they'll settle some outstanding tax issue that had not been previously understood, and they will get on their merry way.
You know, and and it's, you know, not, we don't want to make this into weird politics and all this, but like it's there was a headline, CNN had an article about, you know, calling for the release of two young Americans who've been held in China because apparently their father has been wanted in China, who was originally Chinese citizen, but who's, you know, been accused of massive fraud. And so, like, they're kind of holding his kids there until, and they're like, these kids are American citizens, you know, and they're like, hey, you guys, we're going to make a guess here until dad shows up. Well, you know, anyhow, we're not going to talk politics here, though. So, gene editing guy, you know.
It is known that it is a different way of living out there. And this is an example of, you know, the great differences that we have culturally between us and China.
Yes, yes. Who's to say who's right? And we all have progress that needs to be made. So I'll make that clear. But anyhow, so the scientist there. So I think that, you know, we'll find out, you know, we'll find out the real story, you know, a year from now when nobody cares. But for the Chinese government, you know, I think clearly, you know, they're very, very into, you know, some people are saying that, you know, it's, if you want to do some kinds of research, it's the only place to go is to China, is because, you know, China is a lot more forward as far as allowing certain kinds of research. So, but I think that they're, you know, I don't quite know if he crossed any legal lines there, but we'll find out more. So anyhow, that was conclusion to the story from last week.
There we go.
There we go.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you guys this, and I don't want you to like, I don't want to like have you panic. I don't want you to go like, oh my God, we can do this.
That's the best way to get someone to not panic is to tell them, I'm going to tell you a thing and don't panic when you hear it.
Yeah. Or like, hey, I don't want to start an argument.
Yeah.
With all due respect.
Yeah. No, but like, hey, a rocket launched today and the first stage landed. And it was the third time the first day. Actually, this was kind of a big deal. Like, so SpaceX had another rocket launch today. What? And they, you know, reused a rocket booster. It's like old news now. Like, who cares? We do that all the time. And that's kind of how awesome it is. It's become routine. But what's cool is SpaceX launched actually it's called like a Frankenstack. It was a satellite containing 64 separate mini satellites that were ejected from it, ranging from communications experiments and government payloads to an art project that featured a canopic jar representing the first African-American astronaut tragically died during a training mission. So never got to go into space. And now there's this representation there. What's cool is the booster they used to send this. I mean, it's all cool. The cool part I'm going to mention right now is the booster they used to launch this. This is the third time they've used it. This is three times they've used this booster.
Wow, that's great.
So,
And so this would hold the record, right? This is the most reused that we have. Which, I mean, I guess, do you know what the projected life cycle is for these boosters, or are we just figuring it out as we go along?
Their goal, I believe, with this is the, you know, F9, like full stack, whatever. I want to say their goal is like 100 per or something like that. I mean, I can look this up. What's cool though, if you can pull up a photo, Bryce, of this before it launched, if you want to take a look at the booster, what it looked like.
It looks kind of dirty and dingy.
Yeah. it's covered in soot. They just said like, hey, there's no point to trying to
clean this up.
Really? You would think that the cleanliness of the exterior shell would be important. I mean, it's rocket science. Mm-hmm. It's literally rocket science.
Well, but also, I mean, they can be next to godliness by shooting a rocket into the sky. So who needs cleanliness?
So the point is, like, that's actually like that soot is sort of worked its way into the paint job. And so trying to like clean it would involve like, you know, totally like stripping it down, which goes against the purpose. So the soot is sort of part of it. I kind of like the fact that we're launching, you know, you look at your jet engines in the back of those and they're sort of sooty. And like, yeah. I love the fact that we live in this age where now we're launching rockets that look like the Millennium Falcon, you know, as far as, you know, scuffed up, which, you know, feels very realistic. So yeah. Block 5, which is what they're launching now, the plan is they want to fly each one 10 times with only an inspection in between and up to 100 times with refurbishment. So. Wow.
So this is now we're at three of them doing it. That's amazing, remarkable. And again, you know, not to, we need to hammer this point home, but this is where the savings comes in, ladies and gentlemen, the more we can reuse it, the cheaper all of this gets, the more things that can go into space. Because for, you know, and that's a very touching art installation that has, you know, gone into space with this mini sat explosion. But I would take a wild guess that no matter how pure of heart and touching that art installation is, previously putting that up into low Earth orbit would probably be out of the budget for most people, you know, unless you really, really, really wanted to spend a lot of cash on this. Now it makes sense.
Yeah.
So what? Yeah, and precisely. So what's kind of awesome about this is the company that bought this launch. I think they're space flight systems. They were wanted to be like, hey, we wanted to provide payload support, help people launch things into space. And then, you know, the CEO of the company is like, why don't we buy our own SpaceX, you know, our Falcon? Why don't we buy our own Falcon to do a launch? Because they're looking at, you know, the price tag is like 60, 70 million, something like that. They looked at that. They're like, well, that's a lot. But if we split it up, you know, we find enough paying customers, because some people will pay, you know, 10 million. Some people might pay 500. If we buy this payload and we're doing this called like a sun-centric orbit. So the payload's going to be facing towards the sun. Mm-hmm. So they can, you know, so we find some people who are willing to go on board there. And they got, you know, 64 payloads there, including like a high school, you know, which is awesome.
So is this secondary company selling a SpaceX payload, or is SpaceX facilitating this?
They went to SpaceX and they said, hey, how much for you to launch one of our payloads? And like, yeah, you know, it's like, you know, whatever the six, forget the price tag, like 50, 60 million. This is what it'll cost. Like, great. We take a deposit and we're going to go out and we're going to find some other people who want to launch something but can't afford an entire launch.
Sure.
And
split,
you know,
it.
Yeah. So they just, they bought it and they sublet it, which we're going to see more of that now. We're going to see a lot more of that now. And when you start thinking about when the Starship, the big Falcon rocket, starts to fly, and you can go put this thing up for weeks or months in time in orbit and have a mini space station, you're going to see people say, hey, you know, we're going to take slots for, you know, 20 researchers and payloads to go do experiments on this thing. You know, wow. We're going to get a lot more of this. It's exciting. Now, SpaceX did a launch today. How long do you think before they do their next launch?
Oh, man. I mean, it's rocket science. I would say it's anywhere between, a week and several months, maybe.
How about tomorrow? Oh,
my God.
Wow.
From Canaveral as well?
Yeah, this one was from Vandenberg. The next one tomorrow will be from Canaveral. They're going to be launching a resupply mission. So, I mean, a 24 hours, you know, two launches in almost 24 hours.
That's incredible.
The future.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's kind of amazing about it is you know, from SpaceX's point of view, the idea of that third party kind of subletting it and making sure that you can get all these mini sets on there is great. I mean, as long as you know, there's nothing that would damage the viability of the mission itself, then SpaceX is in the business of selling payloads. So if somebody else wants to go do it for them instead of SpaceX having to find you know everybody else to do it, that's awesome.
Yeah.
From their perspective,
it is a wonderful win-win for everybody. For SpaceX too, they've got X amount of resources, and to try to do, you know, they have teams, people working on sales and stuff, but to have another company say, hey, we'll build the launcher that has all the things attached to it. We'll take care of all this. You just give us a date and tell us when to have this thing show up. And, you know, it's a platform. It's a real platform for, you know, space. So
yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Somebody says, JCO, Uber for rockets. I'm like, yeah, it's a great, and they do that. Like, other companies like NanoRax and some other companies out there that are trying to do like ride sharing for this. And, you know, the more people are aware of it, the more people think of what they can do. Hey, you know what else is a win-win situation?
What is?
Well, would it be patreon.com/weirdthings?
This is true. This is a win for everybody.
It is a win for everybody. Folks, if you want to go over to patreon.com/weirdthings, well, I'd encourage you to. 'Tis the season for giving, specifically for you to give us money. but in return, you're not going to – this isn't some charity case. No. You get stuff in return, including your own RSS feed that gets the After Things podcast to you in the podcatcher of your choice as fast as possible.
Easy and early, baby. Easy and early.
Yeah. So here's the deal. You hear us talk about it, but I would love for somebody to you know, maybe tweet at Andrew or Brian or Bryce or myself and just – Let us know that you indeed took the Weird Things Patreon challenge. You were not a patron. Then you went on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. And then let us know how easy it was to just copy that RSS feed, the custom RSS feed that you get, into the podcatcher of your choice. Because I'll tell you what, I've done it for other patrons, Patreons that I've been a part of. It was the easiest thing possible, and I think it is probably the most revolutionary element of that platform for podcast fans like me and you, friends.
That's right.
So head on over there, patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen, I'm going to send this link to Bryce, which I should have done, I don't know, before the show. But I talk a lot about certain technologies, things like that I'm excited about, because there are things that I think are not quite in the media radar yet, but keep coming up that are very, very, very exciting. And I think that, like, you know, a year, a couple of years from now, we'll be like, oh my God, this is kind of, you know, this is a big deal. And that's sort of what we've always tried to do in Weird Things, is be, you know, we were talking about SpaceX before the cool kids were. You know, we talk about these things because we think they're neat. And I'm going to send Bryce something, which is, I've talked about this before, you know, AI, there's really cool kinds of things doing in AI, in artificial intelligence. And one of these things is there's technologies where you're basically creating apps and applications and stuff that are trying to recognize the images around them. Like we've talked about, you know, like the, you know, GANs is a technology, generative adversarial networks, where basically one AI says, hey, I can tell you if it's an image or not. And the other AI is like, hey, I can generate random noise and finally make it look like an image if you tell me if it's an image or not. And then it creates really cool and scary things. I found a cool application of that was ganbreeder.app. If you go take a look at ganbreeder.app, if you take a look there, somebody's doing sort of an art project where a computer, a neural net generates these images. It's not copy pasting.
I have seen ganbreeder. I've seen this. Like, you feed it an image and it will make like derivative images. Is that correct? Or are these
This will start with seed images, and then here you go. Like, you, he's trying to figure out what you find the most interesting. And so, you know, you click on, like, these are looking like bizarro warped people kind of thing.
Yeah, they're like,
you click on it,
they're landscapes, and it looks like almost they look like humanoid figures, but they definitely are not humans.
Because it doesn't know.
It doesn't know what a human is.
Yeah, the neural network picks up certain features in photos of people, but it doesn't pick up all the features. And one of the things that happens too, the thing you have to think about in a lot of these neural networks that are doing this, they're looking at the whole image. They're not separating heads and bodies and stuff like this.
Right.
And that's what's crazy. But if you go to ganbreeder.app and you keep clicking it, sometimes I've seen nightmarish things of like fur dog babies and stuff. And just, but yeah, that's a basic level thing where, like, as Bryce says, it takes an image or takes images and the computer says, I think I know what this is. Now you can take a bunch of images and a bunch of objects and you can separate them, and the AI can go, okay, I know this is this third of thing. Oh my God, look at that thing.
Oh, it's like a baby's face on an elbow. Oh my goodness. This thing's crazy. Okay. Yeah. This is turning into body horror.
Yeah, it's like a Cronenberg dimension there.
yeah.
But a cool, less nightmare-inducing version of this is NVIDIA, which is one of they've been pioneering a lot of this research, because most of this sort of really cool processing is done on GPUs, and NVIDIA's been really pushing the envelope. So you can use GPU units that are optimized. You can run TensorFlow and other systems for doing neural networks on it. NVIDIA said, hey, let's take a bunch of images of cities and cars and vehicles. They built a neural network that was able to generate basically a driving type game, a simulator game. And you look at this and you can kind of go, well, the graphics aren't the best or whatever, but you have to understand this is not being created by a system that has models of cars programmed into it or cityscapes or anything. It literally took a bunch of footage or images of cities, and then it recreated, it constructed this entirely in a neural network. So it's all it's working the same way when you have a dream and you imagine stuff.
Right.
So there's a video we can see of this. So you have to understand this is all being generated by something that was never programmed in to understand what cars or buildings or anything else were. It just looked at a bunch of images of these things, and now it's creating a virtual world for a driving simulator.
And my understanding is that this is AI generated, but this was generated ahead of time. This is not running all real time, right? It's not immediately procedural.
Yeah, I think they created, they used the AI to generate the environment or generate the video of this. But the idea is that you could basically, in the future, you know, you could be playing, you know, you could play a video game that could like completely generate an entire city out of a small data set.
So I guess they trained it on footage of people driving around cityscapes. Mm-hmm. Urban cities.
Wow. And so this is just all created based on that footage. They train the AI to say, this is what driving looks like. This is what the motion looks like. This is what landscaping and cars and everything. And I guess we're looking at this video where the only thing that was done was that they did separate out certain things.
It recognized what trees were, what curbs were, what different cars were.
Yeah. At the very least, they said that they are different, right? That they are their own distinct things.
But now we're watching someone do the Gundam style.
So what they did is they had a model dance Gangnam Style, then they had this researcher do a poor version of that, and then they had the neural network went back, kind of like deep fake, went back. And if you watch that guy dance again, you'll notice the distortion around him. And what it did is it made his body move like she's moving.
Yeah, okay. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. So anyhow, that's kind of a, you know, AI procedurally generated games. I mean, that's sort of just the idea of the it's scary because like I'm convinced we're in a simulation now. I'm like it's talk me out of it. Talk me off the virtual ledge here, guys.
Yeah, change my mind with a mug of coffee.
Yeah.
So, man, that's wild, and it you know, for the way NVIDIA is sort of positioning it right now is that it's going to, you know, lower development costs of interactive works and all, but you could do some really wild stuff with this once you mix in not just AI generated but AI synthesis, kind of like the GAN breeder thing of like, okay, you know what this stuff looks like, now build a new make of car, right? Create a new car brand. You have all this data of these other cars, these other models. That's insane, man.
Well, yeah, we've seen that with Faces, where you program in, you put in 1,000 photos of famous actors and models, and the computer will generate faces. And it was funny because I clicked on an article. It was an AI article, and I just out of the corner of my eye, I saw a bunch of these faces. I'm like, oh, what's this? Some celebrity recognition system? And then I look, I'm like, oh. No, those were all GAN-generated faces. None of them was a celebrity you'd recognize, but as a grouping, you look out in the corner of your eye like, oh, famous people. You're like, wait, no, they're not. But it just, there's certain features and stuff that fit in with famous faces.
Yeah, wow.
It's a fun rabbit hole, and it's becoming more and more accessible. And I implore anybody out there who has an inkling of interest in computer sciences or computers in general, take a look around at some of the courses on TensorFlow, AI, neural network. A lot of this sounds way more intimidating than it actually. I mean, it's high level stuff to really grasp it, which I don't. But to play around with it and make cool stuff. Oh, what'd you find there, Bryce?
So this is from the creator of GANBreeder @_JoelSimon on Twitter. This is just a collection of images that he got from using GANBreeder, of images that sort of look like knitwear or like royal like vestments and garments. He has another one up here of like, these are all not procedurally generated, but GAN-generated jewelry, just pieces of jewelry.
That's amazing. That's fascinating. And you know, this is where, when this is why you listen to Weird Things, because at some point someone's going to be like, oh, like the hottest new advertising company is generating these things in a way never seen possible. Like, look at all these mock-ups that were created. Like, we're science focused and all that. I mean, talk about, like, you know, somebody mentioned a racing style game, right? But imagine that the idea there is you're not memorizing maps.
Yeah.
You know, you are not, the skill is not in the muscle memory. It is being generated at random, and there's no way for the human brain to really articulate exactly what that will be as you run through it. That's insane.
And a sufficiently advanced one, in an open world game, you get out of your car, you walk into a Dunkin' Donuts, you fill out a job application, and you get a job at Dunkin' Donuts, there's employees that are procedurally generated, the AI creates these people, and, you know, like, oh, you could, it could... in enough data and enough understanding of that stuff, you could have, you know, we could start building worlds in there that would feel extremely realistic, as real as ours. And that's why this is where the simulation argument comes from, is we just watched at a simulated city that doesn't exist in any form, as far as there's no code in the sense of, like, you know, we'll put the 3D models here or whatever. It's just a neural network dreamed the city up. And this is the Pong version. You know, this is the, yeah, the this is the Pong version, and we're just only a couple years into using GPUs and stuff to do this. Where are we going to be in 10 years? What will this be in 20 years?
And this stuff can be used. This could be used really practically pretty soon, right? Like, take the, like, city game example, right? You could use an AI generator during development to have it create all your pedestrians for you, right? You go and you take a bunch of photos of people and you say, hey, these are some meshes of these actual human people. Now go build more humans, or clothes, right? Designing clothes for all these character models. Like, a lot of little things that help make games feel fuller in small ways, not even necessarily in big, you know, geometry ways like this of designing the city, but you could use a lot of this practically really soon, I bet.
Yeah, and I'm excited about, you know, for research points of view, you know, let's build a version of the Roman Empire and let's see what happens if, you know, we find a cure for cholera. What would have happened to the expansion of the remote towns? I have no idea if there would be, you know, whatever. But the point is, you could do really cool kind of experimental stuff. And here's an exciting thing is, you know, part of what some of these systems do, it the core is they look for patterns. They try to find patterns that maybe we're unaware of, and it tries to make guesses on what will the outcomes of these patterns be. And researchers they used DeepMind, which is, you know, remember DeepMind, you know, the whole, you know, beat Go, and then, you know, Al, you know, was able to do with a version of it that never had any prior gameplay knowledge, just understood the basic rules. They used DeepMind's technology to predict protein modeling. Protein modeling is one of the really super complex things in biology, because you have this big ball of protein and you're trying to figure out how this thing's going to fold, how it's going to fold, because the way it folds is going to describe how it's going to interact inside your body, how it'll react to drugs and stuff, because you can know the sequence of a protein, but that doesn't necessarily tell you the shape of the protein. So what they're able to do is basically able to look at the sequence of a protein and then figure out how the thing was going to, the shape of it.
Wow.
So, you know, this was a 3D models of proteins, and AlphaFold, that's instead of, you know, AlphaGo, is the DeepMind's AI generates. They were far more accurate than the other model before.
So these, we're looking at an image here. The top row is the actual way that this protein unfolded. And the bottom is average predicted distance. So I'm guessing this is what it believed that the protein would look like. And it looks really similar.
You see a term up there. You'll see on the left coordinate, you'll see ground truth. And so an AI ground truth is used to basically mean the thing that we know is true, the baseline.
Yeah.
So that was, like, I think maybe crystallography or whatever of a protein crystal showing us what it looked like. And then below was just looking at that sequence, what the computer predicted it would look like. Kind of awesome.
Wow. That's because it used to be, you know, and I'm sure it's still around, but like folding at home, right? Which was just trying to throw as much processing power, not randomly, but as much power as it could to try to figure out these different protein
shapes. And you know, it's going to be funny too, because I think we're going to sit back and look at, and those, like, you know, setting home, you know, folding at home are neat experience, you know, things to do, but we're going to, I have a feeling that, you know, probably, you know, one, you know, NVIDIA or, you know, Titan GPU processor right now, you know, running for a couple of days, probably to be able to do just about all of the processing that we're able to do on everybody's system back in the day, which is not a reason not to do it now, but it's just the way these things accelerate.
Wow.
Yes. As pointed out in the chat room, like, yeah, it's one of the big mysteries about how the, you know, we're all made up, you know, this DNA is like, DNA is this wonderful blueprint, but protein's the thing that sort of makes it happen. And how are proteins folded together is the difference between, you know, nerve cells, skin, hair, everything, how things behave, whatever. And so it's not enough that we have this DNA map, you know, all, you know, DNA sort of says, hey, now create these proteins that go do this. And then that's that, you know, .. profit. You know, that .. is the really critical part. And so being able to understand how the heck these proteins are functioning and what they're doing is absolutely amazing. I mean, not, you know, attempting to. So.
Yeah. We've talked before on the show about a similar like medical diagnoses algorithm or machine learning tool, right? Where it would look at like your eye vessels, it would look at a photo of just your eyes, and it would be able to tell if you had, what was it, like if you were at risk for diabetes or something in that vein.
Looking at retina images, of that, yeah.
It's fascinating to think that we're able to like just put a bunch of data into a box and the box will just figure it out.
Yes. The hard part, of course, is figuring out how much data you need to put into the box and how good you ask your questions. And that, you know, the job of a data scientist, it's like 90% getting the data, you know, and making sure there's enough data there to find a signal to it. And one of the things we're doing now is we look for the things that are easiest are data sets where you have like A and B. This is A, this is B. Understand the difference. Now we're going to throw in a bunch of things and where it's clear. You know, those edge cases, it gets harder in trying to find fidelity. And, you know, I've known from my own, you know, dumb experiments of like how hard it is to, you know, take, I think there's information that's the signal here. And then you find out, no. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, with anything that you have a human look at, you know, anything you have a human look at now and say, I think it's this or I think it's that, and they are reliably good at this, which sometimes they're not as good as we think they even in institutional settings. Anything a human does that where they compare A versus B or whatever is a great, great thing now for AI to do when it comes to image stuff. It's just the AIs, whenever we've thrown them at those data sets, they end up being way better. And you're going to see that from lab results, you know, to, you know, financial analysis, which just things you can do in the lab alone.
Yeah. Very cool.
So, let's move on. I got a spooky one for you.
Ooh. Ah, we love the spooky ones here.
All right. Guys, I'm going to send you on a plane trip.
Oh, hey, all right. Plane trip.
I love planes. Planes are great.
Justin, buckle up.
Oh, I'll go ahead and pay attention to the exits in case of a water landing.
All right. So you guys show up early. Like, you get ahead of everybody. You get on board your plane, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You, like, get on board your plane. You're, like, a little tired, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I got your first class tickets, by the way. You're up first.
Oh, thank you. Wait. How long is the flight?
It's going to be about a five-hour flight.
Oh, it's good.
Okay.
You can really get your USAT of first class if it's over a couple hours. That means you're probably going to get like two meals. You know, you can really sink into those seats.
Yeah, get some drinks going.
Now, as you get on board the flight, and it's like, hey guys, there's a little underfilled like first class. I think we're the only ones in there. You guys can sit wherever you want. Do you guys sit next to each other, or do you like space out?
Question time. In general, I would say there's not much of a benefit to spreading out in first class because the first class seats are like they have armrests on them. So you can't even do like in coach, you could like lay down across three. That's really not an option in a lot of first class configuration. So I would say I might as well sit next to old Bryce.
that's good because I don't think I've ever flown first class, so I wouldn't have. I would have said, "Oh, same row, but opposite sides of the aisle. You take one half of the aisle. You take that aisle or that side. I'll take this."
That
side.
That actually might be the way to do it. Is just so we both have an aisle seat.
Put your stuff around.
So we can both get up and go to the bathroom as fast as possible.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So you guys sit back there. Do you like decide to just take a nap first or what?
You know, in general, a flight strategy for me is you want to stay up past the first service. Because first service, whether it be for a drink or just, you know, some water, that'll happen pretty quick. And also they're going to get you, if there's any kind of lunch or something, they're going to get that order. And then you can just know for them to just nudge you when you go to sleep. And at that point, you can take a little naparoo. And next thing you know, you wake up and there's food in front of you.
Yeah, I always feel like a chump when I fall asleep. And then I have to, can I get some drinks? Like an hour into the flight.
Yeah. So flight attendant comes by, gives you guys your drinks. Their captain's like, all right, we're taking off now. taking off. And you take off.
All right, we're taking off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it does bear mentioning also that when you're sitting in first class, you can definitely, I have watched somebody get to up to as many as three drinks in them before they take off.
Before takeoff.
Like, oh, yeah, no. They will, number one, for real, I don't know how it's not like an actionable legal position that, you know, normally at a bar or something, you know, you can get cut off pretty easily. And certainly if you are really out of control, they will turn around the plane or land the plane. But in general, man, those first class flight attendants don't give a hoot.
Well, part of it is because when somebody pays for that, they don't want to have to deal. They would rather deal with a slightly belligerent drunk that they can usher off the plane than somebody screaming, I paid for this and you're not going to give me
exactly.
Another.
Yeah, no. So they will. It doesn't matter, man. If you're throwing them back, they will keep your cup filled.
In fact, so I wonder if we have an extra ticket available. Question mark, because we've got.
I'm sorry, I'm late. I'm showing up just in time. I'm sorry. Oh my god, I just ran. I'm sorry. I got into this huge argument with the TSA about the Fourth Amendment and whether or not the right of people to be secure in their possessions necessarily does constitute an invasive search. But I'm here. Hey, where are we going, guys?
There we go, Brian. Brian disassembling his fife and rubbing the perspiration off his pocket constitution. makes his way into the first
TSA
class cabin.
This is a privately run facility, and we are only contracted out by the airlines to do this. You have the right to fly out.
Brian's like, shutting the door. Can't hear you.
So you just made it onto the flight. You guys have first class all to your own. Mm-hmm. Do you sit next to Justin or Bryce, or do you just go get your own little pod?
Hey guys, I'm sorry I got here so late. Where are we going? Do we even know where we're going?
We don't know where we're going. We know that it's a 5-hour flight.
Well, okay. Then in that case, it seems like the most comfortable thing is for us to all sit in the aisle staggered, so that way you're able to talk across the aisle. But then also at any point you just slide over and turtle up and go to sleep.
That's where Bryce was. So I think we're all in agreement. Yeah. We're all zipper style in the aisle.
Aisle seats for everyone.
Yay!
So now here you are. The flight's taken off. Okay. You guys are chilling out, first class, all to yourself, right? Which there's only like 8 seats in there. So, and it's an Airbus A319. So actually, in your first class seat, you know, one of you guys have to sit next to one of the other ones.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, right on.
But or front and back, whatever. You can do front back. Somebody left. So yeah, you're all, you know, you're chilling out. You're talking. You know, it's like, hey, what's up? It's all cool. And then, who gets up first?
I always go to the bathroom before I even sit down. So I'm in theory, like I'm asleep. Yeah. No. I have
definitely found myself looking for the first possible moment that I won't get yelled at for getting up to go to the bathroom.
Oh, really?
Like that is definitely something that I have found myself doing.
If I can help it, I don't want to get out of that seat until I land.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So I will say that I am going to be the one who gets up first then.
Okay. All right. I'm going to send you a photo, Justin, of what you get up, by the way, and you see.
Oh, okay. So he's unbuckling his belt. He's standing up. Ooh, stretch, a little stretch, getting out into the aisle.
Yeah, you wonder what else I'll do? I'll do one of these first before I even get up, putting my palms flat on the overhead, right? And then I'm going to get up. And specifically, there's nobody else in that first class cabin. You want to know what? I'm going to give myself a little stretch right there in the aisle. Get those hammies a little limber.
Do some small lunges.
I just sent you a photo of what you saw.
Meanwhile, I'm cashed. I'm cashed the F.O. Like maybe you can see my half-finished Hearthstone game in front of me as I've dozed off listening to Jack Reesider's Darknet Diaries explaining to me why I should be terrified of everything.
So you walked up in there. Brian's asleep. Bryce is. Are you said you're sleeping too?
I'm watching. I'm watching something on my iPad. I'm sure.
So is this? If we are in the front cabin,
this is what you. I mean, I just couldn't find that photo.
I wake up just long enough to take off my shoes and fall right back to sleep.
I hope I'm on the opposite side of the zipper.
I wedged my clean white socked feet into the armrest between the ones in front of me.
Yeah, I'm taking a picture of Brian for passenger shaming, so I can send it into the passenger shaming.
Like, why does that sock look like a red devil with yarn for a face?
I will say at least he's wearing socks.
I've got my hoodie like draped over my head like I'm ashamed of my face, and then meanwhile I'm just enjoying this dark warmth of my own breath, keeping me all cozy and sleepy.
Now, what I've seen is disturbing. The rest, like, so I can still see Brian and Bryce, Andrew?
Yeah, you just turned around and you looked towards the back, and this is what you saw.
Guys,
Brian's asleep, you gotta wake him up.
I kick Brian in the hoodie. Yeah. And,
I was like, Fourth Amendment, what?
Quick question. When we sat down in first
class,
you know, we get on first, right? Do you guys remember passengers getting on the plane after us?
No, I do. I mean,
I was last on the plane. So yeah. I assume it's full in the back. They have that shame curtain, the poverty curtain that keeps us from the rest of the hoi polloi back there.
Right.
I assume they're back there scratching their butts, playing fiddles, eating rats, whatever the lesser folks do. Probably falling in love, having sex in Model Ts.
Probably bad for a pressurized environment, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, if they promise that, coach, geez, what do we expect?
What are we for? Yeah,
I mean, what we get is the smug knowledge that we're not them.
I remember sitting down in vivid detail, and I don't remember a whole lot of seeing anyone else come into the plane. Do we have the plane to ourselves? Do we have extra rows?
I'm gonna go ahead and ask for the two of them to go take a look in the back and see if they see what I see.
All right, so I get up and I pull back the poverty curtain and I hold my nose visibly as if to protect my delicate lungs against any miasmas that maybe are associated with with the coach passengers.
Yeah, I'm
Jesus.
Brian begins explaining that there is science to this on who belongs in first class and who doesn't.
Oh wait, hold on.
Now what the heck?
Hold on. I just let me take a
hey guys, I don't know if it's just me. This plane looks empty as hell.
Oh shit. Whoops.
See, someone said hell. I got away with it.
I was like, oh my God, I've always wanted to do this. And I start running up and down the aisle, high-stepping comically. And it's like, I say, have you ever seen a man jump 1,000 feet at once? And I do a standing broad jump forward and a little back of the envelope calculation to figure out just how many feet I jumped in that moment.
All right. So, I mean, this is.
So, boys, it seems as if we got on a plane. And Bryce and I seem to remember that people got on the plane. And yet now, as we all have visually confirmed and Brian has high jumped for confirmation, there ain't nobody on this plane.
Wait, did we remember people getting on or did we not? I thought.
You probably maybe dreamed it, Bryce.
Oh, maybe I fell asleep before takeoff.
I turn around and I explain to you guys, hey, man, I heard of this. In fact, every so often planes have to run empty because they have to stick to routes. And maybe we're just on an unpopular route. In fact, one flight attendant said that it was just the crew. It was just the pilots and the flight staff. Mm-hmm. So the door was open. They were just hanging out. And at some point,
you know, what are you going to do on this 3-hour flight? The captain invites them to sit in the co-pilot seat and at one point takes his hands off and lets them actually fly the plane for a little bit.
Oh, that's cool.
I believe that was the fourth attendment.
Yes. I restrained myself.
So, and Andrew bought us these tickets. This is not like we snuck onto this plane. Andrew bought us tickets to somewhere. We don't even know where we're landing yet. I had to pack hot and cold.
Oh, you packed.
Yeah, I
like to pack. I mean, we had different styles of travel.
Yeah. Brian's like, seems aggressive. Yeah, next thing you know, you'll tell me you have a hotel room booked.
So is there one of those little on-screen those little displays inside the back of the chairs? Can we figure out where we're going?
Yeah, let's call up our current location.
Yeah, maybe we're just going somewhere where no one
is very popular, right?
Yeah, we're going to, you know, whatever, Newfoundland or Ohio.
I don't. Relax, Bryce. Okay. You did decide to pack warm.
Okay.
You're leaving Bangkok, and you're heading for the island of Koh Samui.
Oh,
that sounds delightful.
Yeah,
I bet they have. Do you think they've discovered pina coladas? I mean, they've already been making the little umbrellas forever, so I assume they know about the drink.
Now, I like to imagine
the fun
part
is, if we deviate a little to the right, you know, you're going to head over to the Andaman Islands where you have, you know, the people that, like, you know, we didn't talk about that story yet. But anyhow, so yeah, you're just, you know, kind of over, you know, the ocean, kind of like, you know, where the lost airplane got lost.
Oh, are we guinea pigs?
Well, I don't see why we would be. You know what? Here, I ring the flight attendant call button.
This woman shows up and politely asks you in Thai how she may help you.
So she doesn't speak any English?
Usually I do, but this staff doesn't.
Okay, so realizing she doesn't speak English, I just mime Heineken. I say, Heineken, please.
Right.
Because I realize it's a bust.
Okay. I mean, we're on this plane, y'all. Are we going to get phased out? Are we going to get lost?
No, I mean, it's
I have a I might I have a possible theory here, guys. I think that we might be on a famous route. Maybe a route that was troubled in the past that maybe not as many people want to ride on this route anymore. Maybe a South Pacific a flight that was famously lost for a couple days.
Like the Malaysia Air flight that went down was missing. Yeah,
I don't think they ever found that plane.
Yeah, but do you think? Well, I mean,
is this,
I guess,
the plane? Did we find the plane?
No.
Did we find the plane?
I would like to believe that we're just on that route, but everyone's
scared of it now. Brian, ask the flight attendant if they found that plane.
I doing my best miming. I you know, with my hands, I make a plane. I was like, I look at her, and we establish eye contact, and I'm just like, and I point like this plane, and he's like,
okay, I would not tell
that. And I put my hand like in a salute, looking left, looking right.
Oh,
like,
and then meanwhile, I'm doing Brian, you keep going, and I just start doing background noises.
Yeah.
Like, so it's like,
yeah.
Like,
ding, 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 ding.
She taps her nose. she taps her nose like she gets it.
Okay.
She goes back to the front galley. And she comes back with two Heinekens.
Probably the best response to someone making a plane exploding hand signal in a foreign language that you could get.
Oh, where is it?
I remember that press conference. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, where is it?
This is a happy. It was just sort of kind of a fun story. This woman, Latsami Makadu, she showed up for a Bangkok Airways flight from Bangkok to the island of Koh Samui, And it's an Airbus A319, and she looks, she realizes she's the only passenger on that. And they hit turbulence at a point, and she's kind of like, man, this sucks. Like, I'm going to, other than the crew, but they don't count, I'm going to die alone.
Oh, that's amazing, though.
Safely. So it's just this sort of like, but like, yeah, you're like, wow, I'm the only one on this flight. What's going on?
You know, it's actually funny because this time of year, you actually see a fair amount of these kinds of flights because you have gigantic busy travel spikes, which oftentimes means that there are not as many people going the opposite direction. So certain times, like, I mean, I was on a flight once on Christmas night going out to Ohio because I was going to meet Ashley out there, but I had work obligations that kind of kept me. But it was kind of amazing how like absolutely deserted a major gigantic flight is, because a lot of those planes still got to be in position to take everybody else the next day when it's the busiest flight day of the year. So you wind up getting a lot of these things that's when you can really like fly really cheap and B, have creepy experiences like this lady did on her ghost plane.
So a little bit further off to the west of where that route was is the Andaman Islands. And recently there was headlines because an American missionary, John Allen Chow, decided that he was going to visit the island and talk to the indigenous people who live there.
Oh boy.
Now, these are the people that have had like almost zero contact with anybody else. I believe the same group when there was the tsunami came through there. You know, they sent helicopters to go check out to make sure these people are okay, and they went and threw spears at the helicopters. They are extremely private, and you know, use the term even xenophobic, and not without cause too. They've had some problems, I guess, that tribe. They've had other invaders have gone through there, killed them, massacred them, whatever, and so. For them, you know, that culturally speaking, anytime somebody comes from the outside, it's bad news. And so they do whatever they can. And there have been, you know, stories about them, you know, killing or whatever people who try to come there. This guy, John, seems like a nice guy, but was going to go there to do some missionary work. He said that his plan was he wanted to go declare Jesus to these people. And he actually, before he left instructions. He had some fishermen take him there. You guys might think I'm crazy, even all this he said, but I think it's worth it to declare Jesus to these people. Please do not be angry at them or at God if I get killed. And it looks like he probably got killed.
So he had this was not his first encounter with them, right? Like he had almost died in a previous attempt.
Yeah, he had some fishermen pull him up close to the shore, and he shouted to them in English, which probably not helpful. My name is John. I love you, and Jesus loves you. Jesus Christ gave me the authority to come to you. He didn't get any closer, but then he decided to go back, and he thought, you know, he questioned his diary. Is this island Satan's last stronghold, where none have heard or even heard the chance to hear your name? And so he decided to go ashore there, and
you know, obviously religion a bit of a touchy subject, I will say, as somebody who has never, nor have I considered going on missionary work, that there is much missionary work that is done.
A lot of wonderful stuff.
Yeah, with great benefit to a lot of people. This seems imprudent. And obviously you never want to speak ill of the dead, but man, that definitely seems like a, you know, there's a difference between getting the word of God out and getting yourself killed.
So, question, because yeah, we've talked about this before. Here you have this group of people that's the very isolated group of people. As far as we know, in these isolated, you know, the mountain or island populations is also like a genetic term. You have genetic problems because there's not interbreeding with outside. You have high infant mortality rates. You often have very high homicide rates, etc. And you know, where we generally of late, we try to take a hands-off approach. They're like, hey, that's them. Let them have their way. Now, my question comes in from there, and I don't have like a ready-made answer, is I'm like, I understand why we treat a society as a whole, our group as a whole like that. But man, if I were a kid born into a society like that or a group like that, I would sure love to have access to the rest of the world's knowledge. I'd sure like to know what's out there beyond my little island. And is it ethical for us to be like, no, your parents and the older people here have decided this is your way of life. We're not going to give you the opportunity to know what's out there, or is it not?
Yeah, that was we did a family trip out to Hawaii, and that's a real problem. Not in a totally isolationist way, but there's one island in Hawaii that is only occupied by people from that island. And guess what? The kids are finding out that there are cell phones and that there's culture and that there's a futuristic world all around them. And they don't allow any outsiders into the island. And this culture is going to fade away because given their own free choice, given the understanding that there's an outside world filled with opportunity and a bunch of interesting stuff, all the kids are leaving. On the one hand, like, yeah, real bummer, because that was a data point of cultural diversity that I think was valuable in general. But at what cost do you get to say, no, we're the civilized outside world, and we're going to let you die of these diseases, and we're going to let you have life be nasty, brutish, and short, because we sleep better at night knowing that there's a more diverse cultural world around us. And even more so in the case of this, it's like, we're going to keep you ignorant, illiterate, cut off from the outside world, believing nonsense, living, savage lives.
But if this is a tribe that fiercely rejects
and all of those, that
seems like their prerogative.
You're right, because that bumps up against my libertarian mindset.
South Africa used that excuse for apartheid, Bryce. So now you're an apartheid apologist. Oh, how geez. Does it feel?
I don't like that.
No, well, again, I'm using an extreme example because we have other examples of what we say. Well, that's different because those are modern people and subject to our rule. I mean, that's
well,
my thing.
But let's also understand in both of the examples of for modernity, right? We are saying that it is our decision whether or not they get access to this. And I do think that there is a line between making it as welcoming, making modernity as welcoming as possible to those that might want to defect, and saying that there is a moral imperative that we must bring modernity to them. And I do think that it is a difficult question to ask. Like, where is that line? Where is our imperative to say, like, is it something where we should just be, you know, throwing with a catapult, throwing penicillin like into their camps with the instructions on like, hey, if they get fevers, then inject this, right? Or are we just to say, hey, look, let's set up a sign saying, in case sick, bring here. We'll make you better.
I don't. There are arguments against doing anything because the history has not been kind to, you know, indigenous peoples when, you know, more technologically advanced people come in contact. And, you know, the history of the Americas is a more recent example of the history of every other continent people have been on, where there are waves of people that came in later and decimating even starting from our, you know, mother continent, Africa. You know, this has been the tradition. One group's here, one other group comes in there, and it's not, oh, it's good. It's the normal thing, and it's a cautionary tale to say, hey, and that's why we sort of take this hands-off approach, because we look back at the track record of like, hey, we'll help these people modernize. And then, you know, flash forward programs like you had in Australia where Aboriginal kids were moved from homes, whatnot. Native Americans, the United States, same thing happened. You know, forcefully separating children from families. You know, and these things are scary, bad things that we try to avoid. And I understand the reason for caution, but my question is there an alternative? Is there, you know, these people don't have radios, so doing a radio-free America is exactly maybe the best way. You're not going to reach them there, but is there like, if Earth was part of, you know, if we were in the middle of a, you know, galaxy or universe filled with other more advanced civilizations and stuff, I would want to know, as this, you know, person who is this, you know, as a kid, as an adult here, part of this, or, you know, this world, you know, I would love to know if there's something bigger and more advanced out there with better ideas or more ideas, because as a humanist, I'd want to know. you know, not everybody wants that, but I would like to know. I would like to know this, and I would feel be upset to find out they're like, no, we decided. I'm totally against the Prime Directive, guys. By the way, you can bring up Star Trek all you want, and I think it's a horribly, horribly. There's a reason why they always break the Prime Directive, because it's a very flawed premise. My point is that, like, you know, I would want to know. I would want to know, hey, is there more out there? Because otherwise, you're leaving us at the mercy of the people in power, the people in charge, you know. And it's so.
I wonder if they have the means, because I don't know. I guess I don't know enough about this tribe to say whether they do or don't know what the state of the world is or what the state of humanity is outside of the island. But I also imagine if they had the means to get off or to whatever to find to venture outward, that there would be instances of that happening.
Maybe, and you know, but it's hard to know. Is that, does that mean that it decides the will and fate of everybody else? You know, you have in, you know, Utah, there are little town stuff where once women are, you know, old enough, they're married off to the town elders, you know, and they're not really given much of an understanding of what's going on outside the world. And that's, to me, that's depressing, you know, because, and they don't really know, they're not really told that they have a choice or know this. And my point is not to the old people who are there who say, yeah, we want to live this way, but to the young people who are never given a choice.
Right.
So.
But yeah, but I don't think that it is a simple answer to say, all right, so what satisfies our moral requirement? Is it to exist? Is it to advertise? Is it to intervene? And those are all, you know, very, very different things, you know, like.
Well, it's like when you find out, like, you know, your next door neighbor has, you know, kept his kids shut in the basement, you know, and people are like, ah, it's different. I'm like, those are humans. These are humans. And we can say, well, the law, like, okay, so we let all laws dictate our ethics, or should our ethics dictate the laws? You know, I'm like, I don't have any answers to this, but I think it's worth asking. I think my frustration comes from some sociologists and some anthropologists are like, well, we want to preserve this way of life. It's like, it's wonderful to be in the position to have that power over another group of people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there is, because then on the other end, and this is to Brian's sense of human rights on what we should be allowed and shouldn't be allowed to do. You know, there is the question of like, all right, well, even if you're looking at a way of life that, like, I guess on what level do we say your way of life is degrading the larger, you know, human condition, that you know, that you have ignored these advancements?
I mean, I don't know that we should ever say that, you know, because everybody should have a right to choice. You know, my thing is saying, hey, let people have knowledge that there's alternatives. That's it.
Sure. And that's probably where I would come down as well. You know, it is our job to advertise. It is our job to create, you know, just even if they are the faint scent of modernity that those who find it interesting can follow, and then once they are here to welcome them. But you know, it's hard to say. I think we can all agree that unfortunately this young man's way of going about things was probably
not ideal.
That's the real bummer, is like, you know, at the end of the day, like, that's awful all around. There's nothing good. There's no good guys in this situation.
Or I guess
everybody's good guys. I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's like nobody, I can't think of any way to be happy about the way this happened.
Oh no. I think he wanted what he thought was best for this group of people. And I think that he thought, you know, I feel very, very saddened that, you know, we lost somebody who, you know, seemed like probably a very good human being. And now the question is, they've asked the organization he's with, like, how much did you know about this? Did you know that he was going to do this? And that's, that's where I want to know, like, were there other culpable people there? Like, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's.
Well, and also, like, you know, I'm sure in the grand mythology, the legends, the history of great missionaries, in the early days, all of them went into situations just like this. And some of them, you know, brought the good word to these people and saved lives and made them civilized or whatever the stories are. I mean, it's like it is a double standard to lionize the pioneers of it and to demonize the latecomers to it. You know, this guy had what he perceived as the last chance to be the last of the generation of great missionaries who went into hostile territories and won them over.
Yep. And there are some people who did some great works, you know, by bringing, you know, literacy and other things there, medicine and stuff. And there are missionary groups around the world doing good causes like this. There's, you know, good and bad to it and a lot of good. So the question was asked in the chat room, says, would I like it for an alien race to come here and tell us how to live? And the answer is no to that or no to this. I don't think we should be going in there telling these people how to live. That's not, if you come away at that thinking that's my position, then either I haven't explained or you're not listening. I want just to give them access, you know, internet access. I want, if the aliens are out there, I want them to say like, hey, here's our Wikipedia. Hey, here's our history of, here's our stuff. Take a look at this. Make up your own mind. I'm always about making up your own mind, not keeping information or knowledge away from people. That's what I'm against. I'm against saying, oh, no, we're going to protect you by not letting you know about these other things. You know, I think that if you're religiously inclined and you're a young person, you should read other religions. You know, if you're politically inclined, you should study other political philosophies. That's all I want is here's an opportunity. Maybe your way of life is great, but you would never know that you made the right decision if you didn't have access to other ways of living or knowing. So who can argue with that?
Nobody.
Great. Let's do picks.
Hey, man, I got a pick. Just got back on the Darknet Diaries train. Talked about it a little while ago. Jack Reesider is putting together True Tales from the Dark Side of the Internet. And his most recent episode, stop me if this is a familiar subject to you, Justin, is about hacking the podcast charts and gaming the system. And he looks at a specific example of people who are offering a service on Fiverr to get you into the top 200 of iTunes podcasts for only $5. And it seems to work. And there's a lot of people doing it. And then it got him thinking like, well, what other charts are there? And can those be gamed? And then he ends up looking at the New York Times bestseller list and all this other stuff. And it's a good meditation on the subject. Ultimately, I think he walked past a conclusion that I don't that seems fairly transparent to me, which is Apple Podcasts. Part of the reason that their system is so gameable is because there's a lot of different podcatchers out there. There are a lot of different apps, whether it's a podcatcher or Stitcher or any number of other things. And I think ultimately Apple can only measure what happens on the Apple Podcast app. And as a percentage of all the people doing podcasts and everything, they just don't have a big enough sample size. So as a result, just 50 subscriptions a day is a big tick that gets you up, because all they can measure is the number of new subscriptions in a single set of hours.
Well, they can also do downloads.
They can, he explores whether or not that has any impact on it at all. Mm-hmm. So that's covered in the episode.
Does it?
His conclusion is that it doesn't look like it does. It looks like it's just just basically new subs, which is kind of what we understood it to be 11 years ago when we, or I guess 10 years ago when we did Operation iScam and got a bunch of people to all hit subscribe at the same time.
I think there's also an element of, or at least what I've heard from people beyond the wall, reviews, also at least at the time that I first had that conversation, is something that does factor into the algorithm, but nothing moves it like new subs is the biggest thing. And also I think it guards against stagnation at the top. It's like, you know, it's exciting when there's like, oh, like, you know, if what you're trying to do is encourage discoverability, then you want chaos in the top 20 because there are new things to discover and right. You can show social proof that, oh, okay, well, people are really into this. So I have not listened to that yet, but I will also recommend an episode of that of Darknet Diaries that I think was before that. That was a very interesting look. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was now, but I remember I really the IRS the IRS breaches and how clever some of the scams that were run from it. Basically, they just used an insecure way that you could request somebody's form back and then refile somebody's taxes as yourself and collect their refund. And the extensive network that was created out of Nigeria of not only getting that information, but finding Craigslist patsies to file the claim and to pay them a portion of it and take the rest. But I think that show is A, very well done, and B, I love episodes like that are kind of you know, gets into some of the dirt under the fingernails hacking element of like, oh cool, look, the hacking is in general, and InfoSec specifically is about finding the little seams in our world and exploiting them, and it's always interesting to see.
That's any of you guys been a victim of one of those IRS scams or anything like that?
I mean, they won't stop calling me when they're creepy robot voice.
Yeah. I had a period where somebody, I think, filed or whatever false returns under my name, and it was like, oh, it was frustrating because like I couldn't get like a PIN code. I had to go through all these other hoops to be able to file to do that with, which was frustrating. And you know, and then I'd get like, hey, we need another copy of your, you know, I'd get like, you'd get the phone calls from my little legit, like, you know, IRS numbers call up like, yeah, we show you reported this amount. I'm like, no, this is what I filed. Well, this was refiled here, and you know, frustrating.
Wow. Yeah, it was a really insecure system. Like they were it was effectively, it's like all they really needed at the time to get an old tax return from you for free online instantly was basic information that for somebody like Andrew or me or Brian with like Wikipedia pages and a trail of work online was fairly easy to find, way too easy to find.
Picks.
Hey, I got a pick. I've held off on this pick because it's a controversial show in my life. I know I've had many conversations with Andrew about it. The season finale is next week, and it is at this point that I am willing to recommend to you, dear listeners, that although imperfect, I find the new season of Doctor Who to be a very meaningful and important step forward in the franchise. Not only that, but a real indictment of specifically the last few seasons of the old leadership, the old guard. Here are things that I really like about this new season. Number one, it's more of a science fiction show and less of a science fantasy show. There's only so much that you're really going to be able to push that line, considering it's about a magical person in a magical box that can kind of go anywhere. But at the very least, you can establish rules in your world and then not totally write yourself into corners that you have to fabricate ridiculous, we found the magic amulet endings. Number two, the Doctor is the most eccentric person in now her universe, which was something that was a big problem, I think, with the previous few seasons, where the entire universe was wackety schmackety and everybody had a funny one-liner and everybody was falling in love with each other and kissing. And it's like, okay, like it shows you how much the world matters more when this is a wacky person who comes into your life. And now everybody else is normal and wondering what's happening while you go on this adventure. But there's also a couple other meaningful things. They've relied a lot less on CGI effects. It's a lot more practical stuff. And all the plots, I think that there's three companions in this season. They all have relatable arcs. Some, I think, have kind of fallen off more than others. But, you know, one of them is an older, you know, an older guy who, you know, whose wife has just died. And you know, the whole season is, you know, I think it's a great story that Doctor Who can tell of, you know, now he's, you know, he has a choice of either to keep following this crazy alien through time and space, but the option is I have to go home to an empty apartment and I have to deal with all that. And that's like, these are the kind of stories that you can tell in that universe that I think are lost when it's all about the Gaga. It's all about when are the Daleks going to come in, or let's put all the work into like, oh man, what a clever thing this clever character said or did, instead of, you know, the episode that just aired kind of pays off a lot of what I had just kind of set up. And you can only really do that if you care about this character, you care about why they're there. And now you force, you know, this is, it seems like kind of basics, but the end of each episode involves stakes we understand and decisions being made by characters that we care about. Hey, it's not about whether or not you can get the master to cry in a soup bowl that came from some ancient a Gallifreyan cupboard or something. It's like, no, it's about whether or not this person's going to make a decision that impacts where things are going. So I do have criticisms, but I will keep it positive, and I will say that it is, if you got burnt out from the sickly, sweet, and I would say poorly written last few episodes, this is a meaningful reboot of the series.
If I've not watched any Doctor Who, I've seen maybe half of an episode, randomly, would you say this season is okay to start off with?
Yes, because it's also, because it's a different showrunner, I think that they made a real big decision to kind of hit a reboot button on, like, all right, we're not going to, somebody from last season's not just going to randomly show up and we're all going to act like we've seen them before. At some point that might happen, but it has not as to this point. So I would say, yeah, this would be a good time to jump back in.
I gave up back because it would be like, there are characters I'd find annoying and then they'd die off or go. I'd be like, finally. And then the character would show up again. I'm like, why are you doing this? I waited for them to leave and now they're back. And
I think it's a little bit more X-Files and a little bit less Torchwood.
Cool. Thank God.
And that's I think where, you know, it'll always still be Doctor Who. It's never going to be as super creepy and weird. But there are moments in this season that are like genuinely like we're doing a horror series. This is a horror episode, and it should be scary. And even in times where there's a little bit more levity, you know, there was it didn't really factor into the plot, but there were like gigantic flesh eating moths in the last episode, and they were practical effects. They weren't CGI, and people are dying because of flesh-eating moths, and you're like, okay, cool. I can be scared of this. It's not, you know, a weird CGI lizard who's going to wink at you, although there's a talking character. All right, anyway.
I know.
But it's fine.
Bryce?
I have a thing. So I've talked before about programming games like Human Resource Machine and 7 Billion Humans. So I found a new one over the weekend that I really liked, which kind of had a different take on it, which is called Exapunks. The idea for this one is that you are programming exas. So these are like little code machines, and each one can have different code. And you're traveling, you're making them travel around a network map and having them, you know, pick up files, read the cursor, go, you know, send the cursor to this person. It's really well made. And I think there's like a feeling of physicality to it. Like, I was playing 7 Billion Humans over the weekend also. And there's one where it's like, oh, I'm getting a fax. So just take all the data cubes and just put them all over the floor, where this one actually has like kind of a heavy sort of narrative story of like, you are a former hacker and you're sick. And so you make a deal with some weird person, which is probably her machine, to like do hacks for this machine. And you will be given the money to get treatment medicine for the disease that you have. And they're playing with some interesting things of like, oh, well, the disease that you have turns people into computers. And so they're clearly like setting up for some big like organic mashup between those two ideas. But the other thing is that the way it teaches you, and there's some other games that do this, like, I can't remember the name of it now, but the game actually presents like the code language of the world in zine format. Mm. So at various points in the game, you get zines, and they have like articles and a library of code. But the game actually has will let you can print out the zine, and if you use letter paper or A4 paper, you pick the thing and you print it out and you fold it and staple it, and you have like the physical thing with you,
like your copy of 2600.
Yeah, so it's fun in like it really embraces kind of this aesthetic that it's trying to do, and I think it seems like it has kind of a high degree of difficulty for one of these programming games. This is from Zachtronics, who I believe they did Shenzhen.io, and they did Opus Magnum, TIS-100, Infinifactory. So like a lot of previous programming games. So
what's the name of this again?
Exapunks. EXA Punks.
XA at XO. All right. Which was.
Oh, yeah.
Very
and
cool.
It's on Steam.
My pick, just a quick little news update, by the way. Brian, earlier in the show, we talked about SpaceX did a launch. They landed a first stage booster.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, we know they do that all the time.
Right.
Now, so, you know, but they actually third time they've been able to use this booster. Elon Musk just tweeted out a little while ago, they've been trying to recover the upper stages, the fairing's a covering that goes over the satellite.
Right.
And what they've been doing is they've actually have like parasails on them so they can kind of like guide down and land in specific places. They've been trying to catch them on a boat, Mr. Stevens. They haven't been able to do that, but Elon says the fairing's made a very, very nice landing in the water. And he says, I think they're going to be able to dry them out and use them again because they weren't exposed for too long. Uh-huh. And there was not any apparent damage from the impact, which is kind of cool because that's about, we saw them at the factory. Remember, that's like a $6 million piece of hardware that goes over the rocket. So between, you know, 50 or 60 million for the first stage and the 6 million for, or 40 million for the first stage, like 6 million for the fairings. It's great.
Dude, that's great.
Nice.
So, my pick is, I don't want to get too controversial. I don't want to pick something that the critics really loved and the audience has liked, but not as much. And I don't want to come across as really, really highbrow in my pick. So I'm just warning you. I just watched it. I enjoyed it. And you're like, oh, Andrew's putting on an air, he's agreeing with all the critics. But sorry, sometimes it's just that. Paddington 2.
Oh my God, it's so good.
It's fun. It's just, it's not like, it's, it's got like 100% of Rotten Tomatoes. It's not, you don't watch that and go like, this is the best movie I've ever seen, you know, or anything like this. But if you watch it, you go, it's delightful. Everybody's delightful in it. It's a fun, enjoyable movie, and really, really liked it.
Yeah,
and Hugh Grant was amazing.
It does get like an automatic upgrade too if you watch it with a loved one under the age of 15. I mean, it's just purely magical. It's really delightful.
I didn't do that, but yeah, it's just such a sweet, well done movie. The core message to the movie is that, you know, Paddington brings out the best in everybody, and he does that. And then, you know, the Hugh Grant character is just great. It's just delightful to watch him play that kind of role.
What prompted you to watch Paddington 2?
Well, I liked Paddington 1. So.
Oh, okay. I just thought, okay.
Are you judging me?
That was no. I was asking like if it just popped up on Netflix or
yeah.
It's on. I think it's on HBO now.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
So I have Amazon Prime and I subscribe to HBO through that. Mm-hmm. Which I just got like a new 75-inch TV, so that's been, you know, fun times.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, the Cyber Monday thing, but you know, you're like, oh, cool, big TV, and then big TV shows up at your door, and I'm like, this is bigger than my apartment. I'm just gonna live in this box now. But yeah, it's funny because my girlfriend was able to help me install it, and she weighs half as much as the TV, so that was fun. It's mounted on the wall. Fun times. Yeah, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.